If Shay, can you turn up the lights a little bit? Okay, and we have communion tonight too, so there are still some seats available up here. Okay. So Judges chapter 9. You know that the interesting thing, that the cool thing, and maybe the hard thing in Christianity is that God promotes us. God's the one who works in our lives in such a way to where we don't have to promote ourselves. And He does that. In fact, we've talked about in the book of Jeremiah, specifically talks about the fact that we're not to promote ourselves. We're not to seek for ambitious things in a worldly way. And we're to allow God to promote us. And He's the one who opens doors. He's the one who shuts doors. And you know, the thing about Jesus is He never looked to attain certain offices. He had those certain offices because He was that. He was a pastor because He was the good shepherd. He was a teacher because He was the bread of life. These offices are really opportunities for us to be what we are. And the opportunities for us to be what we are in Christ should be something that we are regardless of the title or the designation or the position that comes after that. And see, if we are teachers, then we'll teach. If we're encouragers, we encourage. We don't have to have a title or anything like that. But it's interesting how biblically God frees us from the worldly notion and the worldly idea of going and attaining. In fact, it's just completely the opposite in a spiritual sense, to where we're completely free to simply be passionate about our relationship with God. And He promises that He will take care of all the other stations in life, positions in life. How He wants to use us then becomes His responsibility. And so we're talking about selfish ambition. That ambition, Webster's Dictionary, we talked about, it's the desire for preferment. Wanting to be preferred over somebody else. Wanting to be the superstar. Wanting to be the popular one. Wanting to be the one who gets noticed. Wanting one's name to be known. That sort of thing, in a spiritual sense, has absolutely no place. Because in a spiritual sense, it's all about the glory of God. And God allows us to serve Him and minister to Him. And when we see ourselves beginning to strive for position or love the applause of men or desire certain things so that we'll be noticed, we're in trouble, really. We're in a bad place. And so we're looking at, through the story of Abimelech, we're looking at a guy who we see the folly of selfish ambition through his life. You may recall, we've been talking about this story, and we've seen how this guy Abimelech was the son of Gideon. And Gideon specifically said, when the people wanted to appoint him as king, he specifically said what? Do you guys remember that?
He said, "May the Lord be your king."
Exactly. They wanted to appoint him as king, and he specifically said, "No, no, no, no. God will reign over us." And that's the theme through the whole book, is God reigning in the life of the people. It was to be as if there's no specific man king that would reign over them. But they were after that. They pursued that. And then it opened the door for Abimelech, the son of Gideon, after this great victory, for him to take advantage of what his dad had done and to usurp a position that was never given to him by God, to take a place that was outside of the God's will, and a place that there wasn't even a place. And so we see the downfall of that. Abimelech was a guy who was destined to be great in his own eyes and in the world's eyes. And so he went about ruthlessly planning and plotting and scheming and manipulating and deceiving to get what he wanted. And he did that by going to a group of people called the men of Shechem. You remember them? The men of Shechem, they were part of a group of people who were related to him. Gideon, because he had so many wives, he had 70 sons. And Abimelech went to the men of Shechem and said, "Hey, do you want 70 sons to rule over you? Wouldn't it be better if I just did it?" And he convinced them through manipulation that he would reign over them. And they said, okay. And so they gave him money from the idol-worshipping temple, which is an indication of the spiritual condition which led up to the downfall and the men of Shechem being susceptible to falling prey to having a man rule over them. And with this money, Abimelech took the money and he found ruthless, reckless, worthless men to go with him to kill his own family members, the 70 sons of Gideon. And he put their heads on a block and he killed them. And then he began to reign as king over these people. But there was one brother who got away and escaped. Do you remember his name? Right, Jotham. He escaped and he then gave this parable. This parable explaining, and the first parable in the Bible, by the way, this parable explaining the folly of what was happening. And as he explained that, he then got in and prophesied that if they were doing the right thing, everything would be okay. But he also said if they weren't doing the right thing, then they would be consumed with fire and they would be injured and hurt and the wrath of God would fall upon them. And so that brings us up to what we're looking at today in Judges chapter 9. And we're going to start at verse 26, where we are introduced to a new character. So the condition right now is the children of Israel have their king in Abimelech. He's got it. He made it. He attained it through power and deceit. And now he has a time where he's reigning. He's probably enjoying what he has accomplished. And so let's start in verse 22, just to backtrack a little bit. It says, after Abimelech had reigned over Israel for 3 years. So there was his short time. And that's how it is with selfish ambition. You may get what you want, but there will always be an end to that. He had his 3 years and that was it. And so you go down to verse 26 and we have a new character introduced. It says, now Gaal, the son of Ebed, he came with his brothers and he went over to Shechem and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. So the men of Shechem were on Abimelech's side. This guy comes into the scene, Gaal, and now he gets the confidence of the men of Shechem because they're very susceptible. They are wishy-washy because they didn't have their faith anchored in God. And so Gaal was able to convince them to come to his side. So we see this coup, this mutiny beginning to take shape. It says in verse 27, so they went out into their fields, they gathered grapes from their vineyards, and they trod them, they made merry. They got drunk, basically. And they went into the house of their God. They were drunk and worshiping false gods. And they ate and they drank and they cursed Abimelech. You're not going to make good decisions when you're drunk and worshiping idols. You never want to be in a place where you're deciding things about how your future is and the decisions you're going to make in your life when you're not honoring and worshiping God. You're always going to make bad decisions. But it says in verse 28, Gaal, the son of Ebed, he said, who is Abimelech And who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbabel? That's Gideon. And is not Zabel his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why not, or why should we serve him? If only his people were under my authority. Now we see how selfish ambition seems to work in certain circles. We see that with Abimelech, but we see because of his ambition, we see somebody else trying to knock him off with the same sort of ambition that he had. And so this Gaal guy is saying, hey, why should he reign over us? Why should he be king? Why shouldn't it be me? I can do better than him. That's, you see this attitude prevalent in people with selfish ambition. And he says in verse 29, if only this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. And so he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. He's basically calling him out. He's saying, hey, all right, Abimelech, I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to see what you're all about. And so we see this pride raising up. We see this man, this counterforce. And isn't it interesting with selfish ambition, it's always like that. It's men fighting against other men for this prize of power and possession. And it's a shame when you see that in Christianity, in church. That should never be in church, but you do see that. And you see men with the wrong motives trying to fight and crawl their way to the top so that they would have that top position. This is what we see here. Now, we get into verse 30, and we're going to see, if you're taking notes, this section shows us how selfish ambition, it blinds us. People become so caught up with what they are trying to achieve that they become blinded to reality. Watch this. When Zabel, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger was aroused. So we have the introduction of this character, Zabel. Now, he was sort of like the governor over the area. Imagine Abimelech was the king, or maybe like the president. And this guy, Zabel, he was the governor over the area of Shechem. Now, the Shechemites, they were people now who shifted their allegiance from Abimelech to this guy who was really promoting himself, Gaal. And this governor of the city, Zabel, he now hears what's going on. He hears this guy, Gaal, is turning the people of Shechem against Abimelech, the king. And so in verse 31, it says he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, take note, Gaal the son of Ebed and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are, fortifying the city against you. So Abimelech wasn't directly in the city. And so Zabel was in the city, and he sends word out to Abimelech. And he says, hey, these people are coming against you. They're challenging your authority, and there's a one particular person that is there that is heading the charge. And they're fortifying the city. They're making it strong against you so that you won't be able to attack them well. Basically, challenging Abimelech and warning him and giving him a heads up of what's going to happen. In verse 32, therefore, here's his advice. He says, get up by night, you and your people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be as soon as the sun is up in the morning that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may then do to them as you find opportunity. So how good is this guy's advice? We don't really know, but we don't see consulting the Lord. We don't see prayer. We see panic. We see jumping to conclusions. We see some vulnerabilities in Abimelech because of his selfish ambition. It made him paranoid because he realized the kingdom was not given to him. His position was not given, but that he took it by force and was outside of God's will. And so now you have a guy that has to defend himself. He has to be on guard against any threat that may come his way, a threat of power. And so you see him taking counsel. You see his vulnerability now. Taking counsel from this guy. This guy's telling him what he should do. This is interesting because Abimelech was the king. He shouldn't be taking orders from a governor. But because he was so upset and afraid, we see him, what we find in Psalm 1, we see him sitting in the council of the ungodly. That's what happens when you and I are driven by our own ambition, that we will often sit in the council of the ungodly. We'll often listen to people who will tell us things that will cause us to want to have to defend ourselves and cause us to have to protect ourselves. And when in reality, you and I don't have to worry about these things because God is our defender. And if God is working in our life and we are surrendered to His will, then we are perfectly okay with what God is going to do. And so He'll defend us. We don't need to be a people that are defensive. We don't need to be a people that hold on and protect. Ever seen like a little child and they sort of get a bird, they find a bird laying outside in the ground, maybe wounded, and they pick it up and they're loving it so much and they're hugging it and holding on to it that it almost squeezes the life out of it. But we can be like that. We can hold on to people or our ministry. Sometimes in church it's almost like a gang where you have to get jumped in, and if you want to leave you have to get jumped out. We are holding on to people so much and we make it so difficult for them. And when in reality, we don't own one another. We don't own the plan that God has for each one of our lives. And so we have a freedom within our body that we know that God will bring those in whom He wants to be part of our body. And there will be times where where people leave and do other things and go to other bodies. But we don't have to hold on to people because it chokes the life out of the church. And we don't have to hold on to our ministries and squeeze them to death because we're so worried about what may happen. We don't have to hold a heavy hand of micromanaging every detail that goes on within the ministry. If we have God ordained and God positioning people in certain places, we can let them do their thing. And we can allow God to work in and through our lives and even allow people to make mistakes. Even allow people to work through things and to grow in their positions. And that way we don't choke out the work of God because we're not holding on to it too tightly. But sometimes we can do that in certain areas of our life where we hold on to something that maybe God is taking away. Maybe we hold on to a relationship that God may be taking away. Sometimes we're holding on to people or to things or to careers or jobs or all sorts of things. We hold on to it and we don't have that open hand that God gives and He takes away. And we realize that everything we have is not ours. We are just simply people who are stewards over it. That's all. And so God will be the one who brings the things that we're to be stewards over. And He'll be the one that moves people into other areas and things like that. And that way the life of God is active throughout our lives and throughout the life of the church. And we're not stifling the work of God. But see, when it's not God's thing, but it's our thing, that's when we begin to hold on to things. And that's when we begin to protect things. And that's when we begin to strangle and choke the life out of things. We need to be very careful of that. And so we can have this attitude, this carefree attitude to where God gives and takes away. And that's why Ishay and I have never had this feeling like we own people or that the people that God brings to the church are ours. We're just there to serve them and to be helpers of their joy. And that's, I think, the way we should approach ministry. Jesus spoke much about that, how we're to serve. And we have the freedom to know that whatever God wants to do with our ministries is His deal. And we're just there to take care of what He gives us to take care of. A lot of peace to be found in that. But see, when we begin to see whatever God gives us as ours. And that could mean a lot of things. It could mean people. It could mean our children. It could mean the possessions that God gives us. Those are not ours. We're just simply stewards over them. What does that mean? We're managers over them. We're managing God's stuff. If we look at things like that, it'll completely change the way we view the things that we have. And we'll stop holding on to things. And we'll allow God to do and to move and to organize and arrange our lives the way He sees fit, the way He knows we're equipped and we're designed. It's a very freeing thing if we approach life like that. But see, Abimelech, because he had the selfish ambition, he had to watch himself at every turn. And he had to fight to protect what he had because God did not give it to him. And so he had to fight to protect that. We need to be very careful about that. And so we see here this blinding effect of selfish ambition. Verse 34, it says, "So Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night. They lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. When Gaal, the son of Ebed, he went out and he stood in the entrance of the city gate, Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait." So now we have the confrontation. We have the men of Shechem, the wishy-washy people who would just follow pretty much anybody who said nice things to them. We have them now joining forces with Gaal inside the city. And we have the governor of that city telling Abimelech about it. And Abimelech comes to the city to now fight for what he fought for in the beginning. He's afraid of losing. Now we have the confrontation. But watch what happens. It says, "And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, 'Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains.'" That's Abimelech and his people. And this is interesting because now Zebul, we find out, is kind of a double agent. He's in the city and he's working with the men of Shechem and Gaal. But then he told and spoke to Abimelech and got them to come down out of the mountains. So they're coming down from the mountains. And it says, "But Zebul said to him, 'You see shadows of the mountains as if they were men.'" So Zebul, the guy, he's saying to Gaal in the city, he's saying, "You're not really seeing them." He knows that that's what's happening. He knows the men, Abimelech's guys, are coming down from the mountains and going to get into the confrontation. But he's telling them, "You're not really seeing what you think you're seeing." Let me read that again. He says, "But Zebul said to them, 'You see the shadows of the mountains as if they were men.'" So it's just shadows you're seeing. You're not really seeing men. Now watch this. "So Gaal spoke again and he said, 'See, people are coming down from the center of the land, and another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree.'" So he's saying, "I see them. I see where they're coming from. And you're telling me that's not real. You're telling me that that's really shadows." And verse 38, "Then Zebul said to him, 'Where indeed is your mouth now?'" So now he's turning on. He said, "So now you're talking a lot of smack, basically, about how you can take on Abimelech. Let's see you put your money where your mouth is." He says, "With which you said, 'Who is Abimelech?'" He was drunk when he said that. "'That we should serve him. Are not these people whom you despise? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now.'" So you see the Zebul kind of playing this double agent guy. And he's saying, "You're not really seeing these guys come down." With selfish ambition, we become susceptible to being tricked and not seeing things correctly. So at first they're like, okay. But then he sees them coming closer. And he's saying, "I really see them. They're coming down. I see where they're coming from. They're coming to attack us." And then he changes his whole tune. He says, "Okay, well, remember when you said how tough you are? Okay, well, let's go and prove it." So he's like this little instigator behind the scenes, instigating this confrontation. But see, this is how selfish ambition is. Satan is behind the scenes as an instigator. If you and I are driven by selfish motives, he'll pit ourselves against one another. And you see that all throughout church history. You see men and women that God used, and you see this challenge to if they're really doing it for God, if they're doing it for themselves. The Wesleys and the Whitfield, that was the big one, I believe, in the 18th century. And these were great men of God that God used in revival, but the Zebel comes and pits them against each other. They begin to fight against each other. And we see this competitive spirit, this ambition. Satan's behind this, driving people to divide themselves against each other, to fight against each other. And so we're probably thinking about instances where we can think about how God has used selfish ambition in men to drive wedges between men. I don't want to take this discussion past this point, but I want to show you a couple things so we can sort of tie the knot on this understanding that selfish ambition blinds us. It blinds us to what is really important. What's really important in this whole thing is that God gets the glory. But see, when we're motivated by selfish ambition, we forget all that. We don't see things clearly, like Gale seeing these enemies coming down, and he was told that they were really shadows. Well, watch this. Turn with me to the book of Mark. The book of Mark, chapter 6. I'm sorry, Mark chapter 8. This is testing you guys. Mark chapter 8. Now, watch this. This is really interesting. Mark chapter 8, verse 22. Says, and Jesus came to Bethsaida. They brought him a blind man. And the blind man begged him to touch him. So here we have a condition. We're talking about how selfish ambition blinds us. That means if you and I have something in us of an impure motive, of a selfish motive, we're not going to see things correctly. I think the most important thing for any ministry leader or anybody in any sort of position, and the thing that, to me, that I always look for is humility. Humility is such an important characteristic and quality. I think should be the primary characteristic of somebody that would be involved in ministry in a certain position. You need to see that humility. But here you have this blind man. And this blind man is asking Jesus to do something about his condition. In verse 23, so he takes the blind man by the hand, and he led him out of town. So Jesus is taking him away from the people to really speak to this guy, to really minister to him. It's something that he didn't want it to be a thing where the crowd would see and make a big deal, because he had something in mind here. And it wasn't, here's a good picture of Jesus' non-selfish ambition. He didn't do it in front of everybody so everybody would give him some applause and think he's an awesome person. Jesus did miracles so that people would know who he was, and the miracles would teach them something about his nature and his character. And here we see him taken away from people. He wanted to do business with this guy. He had much in store for this guy. So he takes him out of the city. And as he takes him out of town, he spits on his eyes. And he puts his hands in the guy's eyes, and he asks the guy if he saw anything. So he's beginning to work with this guy. He's going to do a miracle. He's going to heal him. Imagine what it'd be like to be blind your whole life. And that moment where you begin to see things. Well, of course, there's a spiritual sort of analogy or metaphor here as well. So where we were blind as people who were not born again, and then we're saved, we begin to see all of a sudden. That is an amazing thing. That although we're blind, that God touched us and we can see things. What do we see? We see spiritual things, like we talked about on Sunday. We see things the natural man doesn't see. We see the heart of God, the will of God, the purpose of God. We see this world in a spiritual way, and we see spiritual significance to the way things are, God is doing things. And so in verse 24, watch this. He looked up and he said, I see men like trees walking. So he's getting a bit of light into his eyes, but it's not clear. It's not sharp. He's seen light, he's seen color, he's seen shapes, but he's not able to distinguish those things. Many of us here tonight may be like that. We're seeing things spiritually, but it's not all in focus. We may be a little confused about what God is doing. We may not understand His whole plan and how it's working out. What do we do in that situation? This is just such a good picture of how God often works in our life. Oftentimes, He doesn't give us the whole vision, the whole picture right away. He gives us more of a progressive picture. And He asks us to take a step of faith in certain areas. We don't know what we're doing, where we're going with this. We don't know how it's all going to work out. But we're taking a step because we know God is leading us. And right now, men look like trees maybe. Maybe our situation, where we're at in life, maybe it's fuzzy, it's unclear. What are we to do? Here's where many people begin to make big mistakes. Because they automatically, instantaneously do not see things, the whole big picture right away, they begin to seek counsel in the wrong places. Why? Because they don't see the whole picture right away. But we see God works like that. So we got to be very careful in our decision making that even though we don't see the whole picture right away, we do not allow Satan to work on our impatience. He is really good at that. And if you're an impetuous person, if you're an instant gratification person, if you're a person that just likes things to happen right now and you want to know the reasons behind everything that's happening in your life, hold on. Hold on, because you may see things a little fuzzy, but that's okay. Don't abandon ship at this point. Watch what happens. In verse 24, he looked up and he said, I see men walk like trees, walking. Then Jesus put his hands on his eyes again. He made him look up, and he was restored and saw everything clearly. Do you see that? So sometimes it takes a little while. Don't give up. Continue to seek the Lord. That's the answer. That's the answer when life looks blurry and fuzzy and upside down and unclear, and it's got that snowy picture. The answer is not to say, well, see, God's not doing anything, so I'm going to do something else to figure it out. Don't do that. This guy hung in there, and Jesus continued to work with him. Jesus continued to touch him. And the key is for us is that we continue to look to Jesus for the answers. And we understand that God often does not give us all the answers up front, because He's developing our faith, and we need that. He's developing our faith. And so if right now our life or the way we see it, it looks like a Polaroid picture that's just been taken, hang on, the picture will start to come into view a little bit better. Things will begin to take shape a little bit more. But the key is that we keep seeking the Lord, that we sit at His feet, that we have our antennas very high in the air, our spiritual antennas, that we're seeing the situation that we're in as an opportunity to learn to key in to the things of God and be in tune and in step to the things of the Spirit. See, this guy just didn't say, well, forget it. Things are all blurry. I need to go to optometrist now or do something. I need glasses. But he hung in there. And Jesus continued to work. Isn't that great about Jesus? He doesn't give up on us. One of the things that God hates from the book or from Proverbs is feet that are quick to rush to evil. That's that being impetuous, being one who just gets bored or impatient and they just say, forget it, and they do something. We got to be real careful about that. That we allow God to work, we let the situation marinate a little bit more, and our role in that is to seek God. And as we do, that picture will begin to take shape and it'll develop. But don't allow impatience to be something that the devil can use against you, that you fall praying, that you become a person that gets into the flesh. Patience is such an important thing in the way God works. Do you ever wonder why when God delivered the children of Israel, he didn't just take them right into the promised land? Does anybody ever wonder that? Exactly. They weren't ready. I'm going to finish with this, but please pay attention to this. This is so important. We get just the most amazing lesson here. When the children of Israel were delivered, they were freed from Egypt. They were rescued. And they had a destination that they were going to. That was the promised land. So God was going to deliver them and take them to a place that was abundant, a land flowing with milk and honey that they would live in. And they would be, it would be, God would be their God. They would be his people. There would be abundance. Everything would be great. But God did not take them there directly. Why? Because they weren't yet ready to handle comfort. They weren't yet ready to handle goodness. They weren't yet ready to handle blessing. So God took them in the wilderness, and what did he do? He gave them food. They didn't have food. They didn't have crops. They didn't have anything to eat. They were on the move all the time. What did he do? He gave them manna that they couldn't have leftovers. There were no doggy bags. They had to eat it all right that day. Why? Because it caused them to depend on God the next day. Every day they had to depend on God for what he was going to give them. Well, when you're in the wilderness, a very critical thing is your feet, what you wear on your feet. They didn't have a whole bunch of shoes. They had one pair of shoes. And these shoes did not wear out. They never wore out. Why? Because they were depend on God every single step that they took. And they didn't know where to go. They didn't have MapQuest. They didn't have a global positioning device. They didn't have something that would tell them their direction. What did they have? They had the pillar of fire by night. And they had the cloud by day. That every step, they had to rely upon God for everything. And God was teaching them something. He was teaching them how to enjoy the blessings when they got in. That they were to depend on him every single step of the way. And if they did not learn that lesson when they got into the promised land and things were good and they were comfortable, they would have then learned something and they would have forgotten God. And so God had to take them. Many people, many of us maybe here tonight are in that position. We're in the wilderness because God is teaching us to enjoy his blessings. And what he's doing is teaching us to depend on him every step of the way. And you know, when things are good, it's very difficult to depend on him every step of the way. We start to think we don't need God as much. We start to back off from our desperation for him every step of the way. But you know, when things are troubling in our life, we sure change, don't we? We have a different sort of desperation for God, and we need that. We need to be taught that. So that when things are good, we have that same sort of desperation every step of the way. And so we see here from this story that the selfish ambition, which makes us think we don't need God, it'll blind us from our need for God. In this story of the blind man, he wasn't seeing things clearly, but God touched him. He didn't see things all the way, and he continued to sit and to seek the Lord, and Jesus progressively worked out what he was doing in his life so that he did see things clearly. And so for you and I, the importance of continually seeking the Lord in our daily life so that we see things correctly and clearly, and so that any false motives, any selfish ambition, anything that we do that is apart from the Lord can be recognized and noticed. That's Deuteronomy chapter 8. You might want to read that for homework. Just maybe the first 10 verses. He specifically speaks about how the wilderness was for them to be tested. To be tested that they would depend on and trust on the Lord. Trust in the Lord in every situation. So what does that all mean? Well, we're going to take communion tonight. We just have a few minutes. But I want us to be thinking about the provision of Jesus Christ. Where God prophesied in Genesis chapter 22 that He Himself would provide the sacrifice. And when Jesus came onto the scene, John the Baptist recognized Him. And he said, "Behold the Lamb of God." Reaching back to Genesis 22, "Behold the Lamb of God who will take away the sins of the world." And so for us here tonight, there's a lot to be thankful for. There's a lot to rejoice in. But I'd like just to take a moment to reflect upon where we are at this particular point in our life, in our journey with the Lord, in our walk with the Lord, and to really ask ourselves, what areas am I not depending upon God? What areas of my life am I making my own decisions? What areas of my life am I doing my own thing? What points in my life am I nervous? Am I afraid? Am I unsure about something not working out? And to recognize and realize that those may be areas where you're close to making bad decisions. And tonight, to say, "Lord, once again, Your will be done." As we look at the sacrifice and we meditate upon what He has done on the cross, we recognize and realize that He gave it all for us as an example, as a demonstration, as a display of His love for us, and how you and I here tonight can take that to the bank and say that if He has freely given us His Son, He will withhold nothing else from us. It's so simple, yet so hard to do. That you and I would trust God in every aspect of our life. And so as we sing this song and as we have communion passed out to us, let's meditate, let's reflect on areas in our life where we're holding back, where we're squeezing the life out of the work of God, where we're not allowing Him to work, and say, "Jesus, Your will be done. Take from me those areas that I'm holding from You, and You be the Lord of my life and reign in my life because You alone are worthy." Father, I thank You for Your word. I thank You for Your truth. I thank You for Your will, Your way, Your power. And I thank You that